Hello and welcome to The Ride Dad Show. You're here with me, your host, Kirill Zabowski. Today, my guest on the show is Michael Fitzgerald. Michael is the CEO of a company called Submittable based in Missoula, Montana. Michael has an awesome story. He started as a copywriter back in the 90s in San Francisco, and then over time became a CEO of his own company. He's gone through Y Combinator, raised funding, had two kids, and after all of that, he's also got a stage 4 terminal cancer. Michael, welcome to Ride Dad.
Thanks so much for having me, Kirill.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Let's talk about it, a little bit about your past in the 90s, because people might, people might not know this, but you lived in San Francisco in the 90s, right?
You wrote
a book about it.
Yeah, a little bit about it, about that in Eastern Europe, yeah.
I read the book, I thought it was really exciting, but you know, let's talk about that life first.
So, I mean, there's San Francisco in the 90s, and then there's also just being 20, you know, which was, I was in my mid-20s at the time. And it was the first, it's exactly what everybody knows about. It was the first dot-com wave. There was crazy money being thrown around at idea, you know, let's sell dog food online. And it was really like, it was the idea stage of the stuff we're seeing now. The money moved faster than the audience was ready, or the potential customers were ready. Think about Webvan or some of those grocery store delivery services that spun up. There was another one, I think Peapod or something. It was a pretty funny time. You know, you could like have no idea what you're doing and suddenly be a web producer. Yeah, it was the other thing. I was trying to figure out what the titles were, because you know, being a like just engineer, web engineer didn't exist. It was, everyone was a producer.
What was your title? Because you joined the software company then, right?
No, I worked for PC World at the time, which was IDG. I started in advertising. My background is liberal arts, and I saw myself as a copywriter. And I went to advertising in San Francisco to try to, you know, become a copywriter. And pretty quickly realized, one, I didn't enjoy doing it. It's not like you just sitting around drinking gin and tonics and whipping off quirky, smart sayings. But one thing I did notice while I was at my, you know, wannabe copywriting job was that the network engineers, all the computer people, the support people, generally seemed pretty relaxed. You know, they would be down in the basement and they would all be at, they'd have lunch and more or less just one, because no one understood what they did. It was hard to tell them what to do. And at the time I also wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to write. And so what I was really looking for was a job that would just pay and not take up too much of my like brain space, so that I could go home and write at night or write in the morning. And copywriting was the opposite of that. That's like just endlessly playing with words, and it's pretty close to the same muscle as novel writing. So I started seeing these guys and asking what they were doing, kind of looking over their shoulder. At the time, if you knew HTML, it was like a marketable skill. So I started just picking it up, and then I went and worked for PC World and was an online producer for PC World and for PC World Mexico. And at the time we were just taking Adobe Illustrator files and essentially creating a GIF of that. And that was a web page. This is the 90s.
How's your Spanish?
It didn't exist. That was the other thing. The translation was a joke. One thing that was interesting, there was a Perl. We built one of the first spam tools in 1996, and it was a Perl script that would run through some sort of data set and just send out an email one at a time, and it would take something like a day to send out 4,000 emails. It was pretty funny, but it was, you know, it was interesting because it was just all new. It was super fun. San Francisco kind of got, I mean, I can't even imagine it now because I don't live there, but I thought at the time it was too expensive and too, everyone defined San Francisco at the time as like the day you couldn't get a cab anymore. And I was living in the Mission, and
What was the rent like back then? Like $200?
No. It was, I had my own apartment, a studio, and it was $650. So, I mean, I know that's really cheap, but it seemed like a massive amount of money to me. I mean, I think I made like $32,000 or something.
Huge. Nowadays, $32,000 would buy you probably a closet in the Mission.
That was what I got paid.
Yeah, right.
I can't even imagine them there now. So,
And now you're a startup founder. So do you see the similarities, bubble time then and maybe bubble time now?
Both industries have matured. The actual like startup industry, the VC, venture world has matured. At the time there weren't a ton of things to throw money at, but it doesn't feel like that now. I mean, I think, yeah, there's absolutely crazy stuff happening in the Valley and in New York, but in terms of, spending, but it's not nearly as like unvetted or
you must have not been following cryptocurrency.
Well, cryptocurrency, actually, that does smell a little bit like the late 90s. You're right. But there are also sort of amazing things being built, Dropbox, like by two people in a garage, so to speak. And at that, at that time, it was literally just web pages that sold stuff, right? Uh-huh. These weren't necessarily online applications. If you think about it, Salesforce, which was really kind of one of the first SaaS platforms, or Right Now Technologies, if you go look at version ones of those, it's pretty funny. I think Salesforce started in 99.
I think the last version of Salesforce is still pretty funny.
Yeah. when you're in it, it doesn't seem crazy. When I went back, when I went to YC, which was 2012, it didn't feel crazy. It just felt sort of professional in a way that wasn't super fun. Like San Francisco's DNA is sort of hippies, and in my sensibility, it's sort of Jack Kerouac, and it's a beautiful city. It's kind of a small town and a city. And when we were there, it felt a little static, and the weirdos seemed gone. And, everybody always feels like, cool things get ruined. I don't think actually San Francisco was cool when I was there. I actually hated it. I hate the weather. Like, it's like, you have to bring like three different, like when you leave in the morning, you have to have three different coats, 'cause it's like 90 degrees in the Mission, and then
It's true, but then you can wear the same clothes all year round because it's literally the same weather year round.
That's true. I think Mark Twain, who's like the coldest winter I've ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Exactly. I think everybody agrees with it, but it's still hard to beat kind of the consistency. I think the consistency is what people like.
Yeah.
Well, so how did you go from, let's see, what is it, the copy title producer in the 90s to a startup founder now?
Yeah.
How did you take the leap, and what happened there?
Well, so I always wanted to be a writer. It was my goal was to be a novelist, and there's not sort of entry-level novelist jobs. There's not internships for novelists. They do have this thing called the MFA program, which are Master in Fine Arts in Writing. And they're generally two or three year programs. And they more or less are 2 years off to just focus on writing. And so from San Francisco, my girlfriend, now wife, she and I started getting hot and heavy. And when we met in San Francisco, and she had applied to graduate school all over the country. And she applied, New York and Ohio and I think Baltimore and Montana. And the University of Montana has a very good writing program. And I had actually lived in Missoula, Montana when I was 2 years old. My parents had moved here for like a week before my mom, who's from Manhattan, requested that they go back to civilization. And
are you saying weak, like literally, or
they came here to look for a job, and my mom wasn't down with it. She grew up in Midtown Manhattan. I don't think she had a driver's license. Like, it's totally understandable. And Montana in the 70s was probably a little rough around the edges than it is now. But anyway, Missoula, Montana had been in my mind. And then later in life, when I was 17 or 18, I drove across country with a friend, and we stayed here. And I just remember, it just stuck with me, like, that it was an amazing place and sort of beautiful. And it was a university town. And, the saying is kind of that we live where people vacation. So why don't you just live here? You know? When she got into school here, I was like, well, I will definitely follow you to Missoula, Montana. And, she didn't come here just because of that, but, she did. And so I moved, and it was kind of great timing because I just sort of gotten some programming skills, under my belt. I'd been working at PC World for a couple of years, and,
So you and Perl and HTML were up to par at that point.
Yes. Perl and HTML, and JavaScript was just coming online. What else? PHP had just all these things were just in their infancy. Not Perl. Perl was a little bit more baked. But so I could make web pages, and I could do some dynamic stuff. You know, I could make sort of a shopping cart. None of the web services that we know existed. So you'd build each one from ground up at the time. And, I came to Montana with my wife, my now wife, and I built more or less a shopping cart for a thing called Clutch Masters, which this guy was amazing. He essentially remanufactured clutches that kids would put into their soup up a Honda, and they'd put these Kevlar clutches into them and this guy remanufactured them. He'd go get a used clutch, dip it in Kevlar, and then we'd sell it online. And people were, these were like $700 to $2,000 items. And we were selling like 10 a day, and he just couldn't believe it, you know, because he had previously only sold retail. And suddenly we're sending clutches to like air bases in Saudi Arabia. And it was pretty funny. You know, we were taking credit cards. I shouldn't really go into this, but let's just say it wasn't the most secure way of doing transactions at the time. I mean, at the time it was fine, but
pre-PayPal?
This was pre-PayPal. Yep. We would take the credit card. I'd print out a email of the credit card, go into the accounting, and they'd retype the credit card back in. And that was how we did the transaction. Then they would run it through, you know, as if someone had called it in. It was literally the Wild West.
You know, you call it the Wild West, but I'm pretty sure that's how the utilities where I live still take credit cards.
That's right. Well, what's funny, I haven't actually looked at it in a couple of years, and I'm now nervous about saying the actual company because we probably weren't doing this through encrypted. You know, none of these transactions were encrypted.
But I think statute of limitations is like 7 years, so you're
okay,
good.
Okay. Well, the place was called Clutch Masters, and I haven't looked. Maybe I'll look right now. But when I looked like 5 or 6 years ago, they were still using the code that we wrote at the time, or I wrote at the time, which was in JavaScript and PHP.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, if it works, you know.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, and telecom companies and banks and, you know, big orgs like that are still running code in production from 70s and 80s that was written in like archaic languages, right? And it's still there. It's still processing your transactions, but if it works, it works.
It is still working. There's pieces in here. They've got I'm looking at it right now. It's still running on, there's definitely code in the PHP. This whole thing is 20 years old. It's awesome.
Someone somewhere is still calling the accountant every time a transaction comes through, right?
I'm sure that I have to assume the backend's a little better, but it's awesome. It's encrypted now. I see that they're on HTTPS.
Are they still built based in Missoula?
Yeah, I know that the owner, I haven't seen him in 10 years. He was kind of an amazing person. He, you know, I think he was a high school dropout. He started this business when he was 16 or 17 and does very, very well. And he was really actually an inspirational person. You're asking how we started this company to make me think, you know, well, I can do something like that. You know, I sort of appreciated his lifestyle. I sort of, you know, being sort of master of his own domain and that stuff. And,
What do you think was the key to the fact that this Clutchmaster thing took off? Because, you know, a lot of people are looking for inspiration, looking to start a company. But here it says, like, okay, a high school dropout went ahead and sold something that people really wanted. Is it the whole PG is make something people want mantra? Is that what got it started?
I mean, you should interview him because I was just fascinated by him. I mean, this was 20 years ago, so I'm going to slaughter the story a little bit. But what he told me was, you know, he just didn't like school. And so he was younger, he's 16 or 17, and he lived near Long Beach, maybe somewhere in south of LA. And he would go to Long Beach, he would go to the docks every day and essentially help out, like work as a scab, you know, like if a ship came in and they needed one more person, he would help out. And then he started learning how to drive a forklift, and so he'd show up every day with the forklift and he would rent it out. He bought a forklift and he would rent it out. And if I remember correctly, he eventually got like a fleet of forklifts. And so he and some buddies would come and rent out the forklift every day to the incoming ships. And then one day somebody essentially gave him a deal he couldn't refuse and suggested he stop because he wasn't unionized or something. And, you know, there are people who care about that, namely the mob, right? And so he was asked to never come back with his services again. And so he was a little bit out of luck and he had all these forklifts. And so he started thinking about like who did he write checks to? And one of the things that always broke on these machines were these clutches. And so he started figuring out how to remanufacture clutch because you could go get the original for free at like at a dump or something. And then he would remanufacture them by dipping them in this molten Kevlar and actually making them better than the original. And again, I'm slaughtering the technology. I don't remember exactly, but it was something along those lines. And then he started building these clutches and then he realized you could build a product and, you know, it's like, in technology, going from a services based, you know, selling yourself as a developer to building a product, you know, when the magic, when someone buys that first product is, you know, pretty inspirational and it's hard to, it's addictive, right?
Right. And it's a great story because here he is turning something basically free into thousands of dollars.
Yes.
All by just, you know, manufacturing a process that others didn't think of in time.
Yeah.
You guys actually have another story like that from Montana. I forget his name, but I was in Vancouver the other day and there was a $200 million yacht parked there.
Oh, Denny Washington?
Perhaps. I guess he's known for that yacht, right?
Yeah.
Because he's a multi-billionaire and he started by basically digging trenches. And then he asked himself like, well, why am I doing all the digging? Why don't I just buy the equipment and have somebody else dig? And took off from there, right? But it's amazing because you're in small town, sort of like in the middle of nowhere. It's not the most popular city.
Yeah.
And yet people actually come up with these things perhaps faster than even anywhere else.
Well, I think Montana and small town America is like ridiculously entrepreneurial compared to the Valley or New York or anywhere. You know, the big things come up there because they have the cash to like make something big. But in a small town, like there's not regular jobs. There aren't, you know, the only people who had regular jobs in Missoula when I first got here were professors, doctors. That was basically it, right? Like everybody else was working in either a small business or doing two or three jobs to like pay the bills. Because also at the time, remote working wasn't around. Like now we actually have tons of remote workers, people who, you know, we have Twitter developers who just want to live a better lifestyle. But remote working wasn't really possible at the time. And so anybody who lived here it was totally entrepreneurial. Everyone was always like hustling and figuring it out. The only difference was the aspiration was to pay rent. Like, they loved living here, so they'd work two jobs just to pay rent. And in Silicon Valley, the aspiration was to like dominate the world, which is good too. You know, I think if we could just take some of that aspirational stuff and move it here, which I think is actually happening. It's crazy what's happened in Missoula in the last 2 years. We've got class passes here now. There's amazing companies like Onyx Maps just raised $23 million Series A, first money in Missoula, Montana. Freaking awesome. Orbital Shift, which is taking on ADP for account for shift management software. There are tons of weird little companies here, not little, but and it is starting to be what I saw, which was, you know, people would do anything to live here, and they just had to rejigger their aspiration from paying rent to being in a large company.
Well, it's a good thing you're saying it being a large company, because the whole Valley, you know, dominate the world, totally makes sense from the corporate point of view. You want to make as much money as you can to return to your shareholders. But I like the small town mentality where you can't just dominate the world and like ruin everybody else's world. Yeah. It feels more compassionate, more about maintaining a sense of community. And you can still have a really big, successful company. It just doesn't have to murder the rest of the world to do it.
Right. No, most of the companies that I talked to that I just mentioned, like the goal for them is just to be like an awesome employer, to have like 500 employees, you know, to create jobs so their kids don't leave. Like that's, you talk to any of them, it's none of them are like, oh, I can't wait to go sell to Amazon or whatever. Everyone just wants to build awesome businesses. And it's super exciting to see, because it, you know, we've been here for 20 years and it just feels like this thing that you could tell was going to happen is finally happening. And there's bad with it too. You know, we're suddenly immediately housing in prices. And ClassPass, do you know ClassPass? Do you know what it is?
Yeah, my wife has spent quite some money on it.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a group, you know, it's a way to buy a membership to all the potential classes in your region. So you can get into yoga studio A, or you can go into, you know, some fitness center, or you can take a class, and it's an app, and it figures out what you're interested in, tells you what's available, and you pay one price and get into all of them. Anyway, they stood up a team. I think they have 150 people here, and they just came here because, one, you know, you're not totally in a battle royale for talent, which Silicon Valley is and New York is. You can hire SDRs. Like, how do you hire an SDR in Mountain View, right? Like, here we've got a college. I shouldn't even say this because I don't want too many more companies to come, but you can hire like educated 25-year-olds who, you know, are looking for that entry-level career job in a high-tech space. And we previously didn't have those jobs, and now we do. So, you know, if you have a SaaS platform that's built around standing up a sales team, you know, cold calling and stuff, at a different ticket price than what you need in Silicon Valley to do that. You need to sell something at $20,000 to support a sales rep in Silicon Valley. In Missoula, Montana, you can sell a $5,000 product. And so we're just seeing tons of that. I think the rest of the country is too. I think, you know, Indianapolis, all these middle states.
People, please don't move to Missoula. Just keep it weird as it is, you know. Yeah. So we can still like live there. You know what's awesome about you, and I don't think you even realize it, but a lot of people would promote their own product and they talk about Submittable and how awesome you are and your employees, and you're like, you know, we're doing our thing and look at everybody else around us. And I think that's part of the reason why you live in Missoula and why Missoula is where you live, right?
Yeah.
It's not the cutthroat, it's that group mentality of just supporting everyone and raising everyone up together.
Totally. Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's see. So back in the 90s, you do this thing, then you get inspired to do your own company somewhere in the middle. And I don't know if we should talk about this, but you were a shadow writer, right? You did some writing.
Oh, ghostwriting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not legally allowed to talk about who I ghostwrote for, but I ghostwrote.
It rhymes with little soft, in a way.
I ghostwrote for executives at a large software company. And that was great. That was really, actually, like, I loved it because I was learning. We wrote a book about personas. And at the time, you know, it was just, it was really like a front seat of how this large software company thought about user interactions. And I learned a ton, you know, you wrote the book talking directly to this PhD expert, you know, it was excellent. And then, yeah. And I also work for a great company in Boise, Idaho called ProClarity that was bought by Microsoft. And so I had kind of experienced startup, you know, a startup there. I was probably employee like 50 or so. And that was super inspiring because the founders were totally normal people. You know, I think in my world, I saw startup founders like visionaries like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs as, you know, well, just geniuses. And how could you replicate that? And the ProClarity people were super smart, but they also didn't seem, you know, to me, it was just like, wow, if those idiots can do it, I can do it, which is super empowering and actually something that I think people around town think when they see me. I hope they do. You know, just by witnessing, seeing it done is 90% of it, right? Not necessarily the how, but just being like, if that person can do it, I can do it.
You've got an unfair advantage. You've got that Einstein hair going on. So when they see you, they know you're a genius, yeah. And then there's no competition from there.
Right. Yeah. My hair is a little intimidating. you've got some good hair. You've got a little eyebrows too. You got intense eyebrows, if I remember.
If I need to stare at you, it gets in the way. But so you got your writing out of the way. That must have felt pretty good. And then you got to Submittable. So,
So really quickly, I published a novel in 2007. I'll promote myself, called Radiant Days. It's genius. Brilliant.
Great novel. The best.
Amazing. There's some pretty funny, actually, I just was, my kids like to read me the 1-star reviews. There's some pretty funny reviews on there if you're looking for some comic relief. One is
if you guys want to troll Michael, go on Amazon and leave him some reviews.
That's right. And then, so I, you know, publishing a novel was a pretty educational experience, namely in that I realized it doesn't pay. And I had probably envisioned, I published my first novel, it's a bestseller, I buy a house and I live happily ever after writing novels, right? And I was so far, you know, publishing my first novel probably put me in debt. And so I had learned that. It was a great experience. I loved writing and I loved publishing it, but I realized it would be very challenging to survive without teaching or doing something. And so I had just gone, I'd been working for ProClarity while I had published a novel.
One second. So what does it take to write a novel? You know, because I'm thinking I'm going to take a year off, move to Italy, just hang out somewhere in Wineyard. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. No, so you're not getting paid while you're writing it. And for your first novel, it took me around 4 years. And so I wrote in the morning from 5 to 7 every day. And how you write a novel is you type, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so for me, it, you know, if you think about code, are you still writing code?
Are they the same pages?
No, well, they kind of are. So if you think, you know how
I code.
Yeah. So you're writing code. It usually takes you like an hour before you're actually like in the groove. Right. You're like it takes you an hour before you can just like start to actually be productive. And then your next 2 hours are super productive. And with writing, it takes you like a page or two. You kind of like got to write into get yourself actually into the novel, into the action, into the atmosphere of the novel. And so you pretty much write 3 pages for every one that ends up in the book, or at least I did. And so, you know, every morning from 5 to 7, I would write. I would try to get two, maybe 3 pages. And then I would go to my job programming, and it was a sort of different experience, different part of the brain. So it was pretty easy to just leave. And then at night I would edit those pages, and then I would wake up and do it again. And I did that for about 3 years. And then I had, you know, I had probably 700 or 800 pages, and the editing process got it down to like 300 maybe. And, And one day you got a book and then you got to sell it, which is it's similar to starting a software company where in the beginning you just think you'll write this amazing, you know, you build this product and you kind of forget how hard it is to actually sell stuff, right? It's very similar with writing a novel. The first thing you realize when you finish, you know, when you type the end is like, oh my God, no one asked me to do this. I'm so fucked, right? Like, no one cares that you wrote a book. No one's sitting outside waiting to pay you for it. So then you got to go sell it, which is a really challenging thing if you don't know how to sell and you're not used to it. A lot, you know, this is sort of the stereotypical problem that developers who start companies run into. They build a product and don't know how to sell.
Well, don't know how to sell is part of the problem. Build a product that no one wants. That's a bigger problem, right?
But I
do have to ask you a startup question and software question about this book, though. You know how Lean Startup got popular for a while? And the whole idea is that, well, before you build a product, go put up a splash page and go sell it and see if anybody signs up. And then if they sign up, then go build the product. So do you think people can write a book in 10 days and sell it and then actually go make the book happen?
You know, I wouldn't pay for that, but I mean, people do any, you know, I think sort of famous personalities probably could, you know, I think, Jay-Z probably could say, hey, give me $10,000. I don't know. I mean, I couldn't do that, but if you have a, whatever social footprint, you probably could.
But otherwise, the life of a novelist is not as glorious as it sounds.
It's not as glorious, but it's pretty awesome. You know, it's no one's telling you what to do. I mean, if you can get paid for it, it's amazing, right? Like you write for 5 or 6 hours a day and go for a run and, you know, it's pretty lo-fi. It's not, you're not on a yacht or anything, but it's definitely not as horrible or not horrible, but it's not as stressful as starting a company and being responsible for 70 people and all that stuff.
Let's talk about being responsible for 70 people.
Okay.
Is that how many people are working for Submittable now?
It's probably around there. I think we're at like 74 and I think we're at 70 now. Yeah.
That's awesome. You guys grew quite a bit. I mean, last time, you know, you and I were in the same room together was like, well, mostly during Y Combinator, and that was what, 5-6 years ago?
Yeah.
And it was just you and a couple of co-founders and a couple of employees. So that's really impressive.
I think it was, we just had one employee at that time and she was stuck back here in Montana. I felt bad for her. But yeah, right. 4 to 70. It's wild.
So what does it feel like to be you?
Well, I'm pretty, you know, I feel fortunate, you know, I feel, I'm grateful to, that it worked. It could be much worse. I'm just getting used to never knowing what I'm doing and figuring things out on the fly. I'm a very lucky person. You know, I've done some things that I wanted to do and I'm not starving and I've got, you know, great kids and fancy wife and I live in a place that I want to live. I walk to work. I don't know. I'm pretty happy. I am very sick, which we can talk about. But if I didn't have stage 4 colon cancer, life would be amazing.
Kick cancer in the butt.
Yeah. And yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd prefer if I didn't have cancer.
That's a t-shirt right there.
Well, how about you? How are you? How does it feel to be you?
Oh, it feels great. I'm just a full-time dad chasing after kids all day long. But, I mean, there's, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side. Of course, I'm like really want to get a company going again and, be engaged all day long. But part of it also, I think to me, your kids are older, right? But I have to, my kids are still young and I feel like right now is a good time to get to know them and do something with them and really understand who they are and figure out how to empower them to be successful in the future. And once they start school and I don't see them for like 5 days a week, then I can do more. But at least in my experience, to be doing a company realistically, at least in the early days, you have to be, you know, in the office, whether it's actual office or by your computer or on the phone, you have to be there for like 20 hours a day in some capacity. So,
true. So, I mean, we started Bruce and John and I started Submittable when my kids were 3 and 5, and I look back and that was a pretty dumb idea. It's, you know, when you're in it and it's your first time, you don't really realize how fragile everything is, like how fragile the company was. And, you know, if you get laid off and you're a startup founder, it's not like you're getting your, like you've lost your job. It's just, you said, you know, like basically being a startup founder is a euphemism for being unemployed, right?
Yep.
But looking back, it was, I think you're right. I think it's super thoughtful and to have the frame of mind to know that this time that you have with them is specific and will end is very smart and mindful, because I didn't see my kids. And when I did see them, I was usually kind of crazed and desperate and probably not the best role model or person to be in a 3-year-old's room, you know. I came home one time and my youngest one, he was probably 3 or 4, was walking in circles, putting his hands through his hair in this kind of thing that I used to do, and just looked kind of crazed and manic. And I was like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I'm being you, Dad." I was like, "Okay." You know, I had to consciously not talk about work when I got home, because it clearly was just bleeding into everyone.
And 3-year-olds don't want to hear about your work, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How many years did it take until you got to somewhat of a stable point and could get back to the family?
Well, I look back and I realize we've never been stable. I mean, we're stable now, but it still feels like, you know, there's always something. And, you know, when we were at YC, we left our families here. So I had kids back home, and I remember Paul emailing me because he saw a picture. I think it was like my Gmail picture. It has a picture of all my family. And one of them's an infant. One of them's like 2 or 3 at the time. And PG was like, "Hey, I don't think I understand. I knew you had kids. Like, are you sure you want to do this?" Like, kind of trying to talk me out of it. And I appreciated, you know, it just showed, it was just nice to see, you know, Paul's just, you know, I think he's, you know, I think he obviously did something amazing, with Y Combinator, but I always just really appreciated how thoughtful he was, and Jessica too, around that we were just, you know, we were human beings trying to do this challenging thing. And, but he basically tried to talk me out of it. You know, he's like, "You guys should go home." And, I said, "No." I said, "I'm going to take this experience. I'm going to go back to Montana. I'm going to build a company with 500 employees, and I'm going to keep my kids in Montana, and you're going to make it possible." And he never, I don't know his side of it, but I never heard back from him. So, and I stayed with it, and I only got 430 more employees to go, right?
Easy. 'Cause all you have to do is raise $50 million and you can hire them all tomorrow.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
That would be a very Silicon Valley.
Oh my God, I totally didn't realize that. I should go do that. Thank you, Kirill. I'm going to do that on Monday.
Call yourself the post-revenue company, and you're good. But you said it's getting better now, right? So I mean, aside for cancer, which sucks.
Yeah.
But the company is more or less stable, and you guys.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is I think you're doing, in a way, you know, there are other successful companies that do something similar to what you do, but you guys have big enough niche that you can exist, be profitable, be successful, have a lot of customers, and deliver value, right, without having to compete with the big, like massive companies that do similar things.
Well, I'm not going to name them, but one of our competitors just went public. So there's there's competitors, that a competing product just went public. It's not all like cupcakes and champagne, but, I don't know. I guess I'm not agreeing with you. There's competition, and it's every single sale is a dogfight. And, it wasn't in the beginning, cause we were going for, most of our customers were small literary publishers and indie magazines and just small niche, publications. But we moved into internal workflows, RFP. We have tons of grants. So foundations use us for this grant application process. And we get, that's probably one of our fastest growing verticals. UGC, so large organizations like AT&T or Nike use us for accepting videos and accepting images from their users and from member organizations, same thing. So there's all these different verticals now that are pretty beefy and have competition. And, we focus on delivering amazing service. We have tons of customer support, which differentiates. It's the other thing. You can't do customer support in the Valley, we have, I think 12 full-time support people. We have support on the weekends. We overemphasize that you can call us, and that's something you can't really do at a big company. But
now I know what to do in the weekends.
Crank call our support people.
Yeah. Just call. Yeah. So you're moving into enterprise basically within niche of customers.
Yeah. University-wide packages, brand-wide packages. And those are totally different muscles, as you know, than what you start with. In the beginning, we were, put in your credit card and give us $20. And now it's, really big deals that come with account management and all that. And it's exciting. And it's super, those first couple of deals were amazing to me.
Is it true that it never gets easier? Just the nature of your work changes?
I agree with that. I keep thinking it's about to get easier. And it gets easier for a while. We've hired executives in this last year, which we didn't have before. We hired this guy. Somebody from Oracle to be our VP of sales, our first VP of sales. And his name's Brady Meltzer. And, he had like a $4 million quota or something at Oracle. And, he joined us and really sort of put some rigor into our process and stood up, we have 30 salespeople now, and has put all those sort of big company processes in place that we didn't have before, which is good and great. And then we hired, she's not joining us until January 1st, but she's originally from Missoula, and she is a VP at one of the bigger brand, I'm not allowed to talk about because she hasn't left the company yet, but she's been working for us part-time since August. And, she's amazing. She's absolutely changed my life, taught me so much about just work and intensity of work and working in a big organization. How do you actually, one of the biggest challenges once you start to scale up in terms of employees is, adding 10 more people does not necessarily make you go 10 times faster. And many times it actually makes you go slower. So there's just some nuances in leveraging those employees and creating a brand and stuff that I didn't think about or care about. And it's been so, I've just loved being part of that, as I never thought in a million years I'd like learning how to build a sales model, but I love it. So parts are really great. Getting sick sucked. I don't know. We raised our Series A last May, a year ago, May. So May 17th. And, I had had, I got sick the winter before. I just had this weird weekend where I just didn't feel well and had some digestive issues. And I went into my general practitioner, and he was like, "Oh, well, I run marathons. I'm fairly active. I'm you know, pretty in shape and I eat and drink pretty well. And he said, well, you should get a colonoscopy because Missoula is a fairly rural place. I couldn't get the colonoscopy for 3 months and I just forgot about it. And I got a robocall the day that our Series A closed from my doctor saying, you've got an appointment tomorrow. And I just said, I had to go look about I'd completely forgotten why I had scheduled a colonoscopy and I had not had any symptoms or anything. And I woke, so the deal closed. I woke up the next day. You know, there was more money in our bank account than we'd ever imagined. And we suddenly, you know, it was a great feeling to suddenly think about like what we could possibly do now and how big we could get. And the next day I went in for the colonoscopy and woke up to, you know, some nurses wouldn't look me in the eye and, they had some pretty awful news. I had, colon cancer and it had metastasized and gotten to my liver. It got into my lymph nodes and, the prognosis was, really, really, it was awful. It was terminal. I was supposed to be dead about 6 months ago. And so, you know, fundraising NYC had actually taught, or the whole startup process had taught me this, that you just, that if you don't hear the answer you want, you just go find another answer. Right. So I got on a plane, I went to Mayo, did a consult at Seattle. I ended up at MSK in New York at Sloan Kettering. And there's this incredible person there, her name is Nancy Kemeny. And she pioneered this thing called the HAE pump, which stands for the hepatic artery infusion. And essentially it's an implant. The problem with metastasized colon cancer is it usually takes out your liver. It gets to your liver first. And then your liver is hard to treat because systemic chemo will go to your other organs, but it gets to your liver and the whole goal of your liver is to dilute toxins. So chemo is not super effective. So what she figured out was that if she could target the chemo directly at the liver and increase the dosage and increase the amount, she could have some success. So like in the 90s, she started putting these things in people and it looks like a hockey puck. She attaches it to your liver and twice a week they fill it with chemo and it does your body temperature pushes the chemo out, does a slow drip over 2 weeks to your liver. And it works and it saved my life. Within 5 months, I was, resectable, which means that they can go in and do surgery before it was too extensive to do surgery. And they went in, they cut it all out. And, I was cancer free from November to actually last week, which, I just found out I'm having a recurrence in my liver, but it's an incredibly small dot and we're on top of it. And, it's not going to be anything like last year, but, going back to the startup, I walked away and went and got this insane surgery the day after. And I had to call the investors. I had to call True. And I mean, if I can, sort of promote any organization, like my board was fucking amazing. Like, True. Could you imagine sending, you know, a large Series A to a company and the founder calls you the next day and says, I'm terminally ill. They didn't even hesitate when I called them. They were just like, go get fixed. This is not, do not concern yourself with this. Everything's fine on our end. I mean, they were just such stand up people. And I'm forever grateful. You know, making that phone call was the crazy, like one of the most scariest things I've ever had to go through. Never mind massive surgery and getting a titanium puck implanted in you. But, anyway,
that's some light conversation right there.
Startup life.
Yeah. And people worry about their fundraising and other startup-y things, right? Like, and you could have a startup and be sick too.
Wow.
You know, that's definitely something people, I wouldn't wish on anyone to experience. And I remember reading a post from you on the internal YC system saying, well, this is what happened, right? And it's like there were people willing to jump in and like at least try to help you find the right doctors. Or did any of that help? Like did the outreach help find the right channels?
It did. I mean, not just one, there were literally oncologists at Y Combinator. You know, there was like the chief like surgical resident from USCF. I can't remember his or her name, but there were, and there's startups trying to cure cancer, you know, like it's a kind of crazy, it's not like posting on Facebook where, you know, your friend from high school is like high fiving you and stuff. It's literally like, oh, I'm actually trying to cure that right now. You know, that was a pretty awesome moment. And then also, you know, the other founder, you know, everyone, you know, what I think my post was just like, have you ever dealt with this? How do you do the day to day? You know, the thing I didn't understand was what did I do? What would you have done? If you were suddenly terminally ill and you were running the company?
Did you have people responding saying, well, I've been there and this is what we've done too?
Yeah. I think Rescue Time. I can't remember the guy.
One of the co-founders.
Yeah. He was sick. And then there's sort of, I haven't been, maybe it was just coincidental at the time and I was hyper like sensitive to it, but there seemed to be a rash of like high tech people getting sick, getting terminal cancer. I know somebody in Seattle, I can't remember his name. I think he had pancreatic cancer. There was a Google executive that had colon cancer. And you know, people blogged about it and I didn't blog about, my own disease because it seemed like there were other, I just didn't want to join into the chorus, but I suddenly want to work on this. You know, one of the things that was pretty telling was, you know, I'm here right now. I'm healthier than I've ever been in my life, other than cancer. Like, you know, I'm in great shape. I don't drink anymore. I'm pretty conscious about, you know, very little red meat, and I've learned tons of interesting things. And, you know, literally when I got cancer, it was the first year of my life that I could afford cancer. The average person, not saying I'm not average, but the general population, if they get cancer, the path is they go broke and then they die. If they're with stage four cancer, like that's sort of what is the prognosis or that's sort of the pathway for most people. It's changing every day. There's tons of stuff happening. I mean, it was so inspiring to see like Jim Allison, who is one of the immunology people, all that stuff starting to like actually happen. It's similar. I mean, immunology was sort of the basic science was figured out like 100 years ago, but like in pharmaceutical companies, it was happening in the 90s and it's just now coming online. We're just now seeing like Keytruda. We're seeing, you know, things get cured that just 10 years ago were death sentences. And so it's amazing. But what drove me nuts was that I got out of this. I'm not totally out of this, but I got a lot farther simply because I knew that somebody out there somewhere was doing something crazy and potentially cured. And most people don't have that option to like fly to New York and spend 2 months in New York while you go through surgery. And I would like to fix that somehow. I don't know what the answer is. I've started actually building a little tool on heypump.com, which is more or less a marketing site for the cure that I ended up with. And it just tells people that this treatment is available in other places, which it is. But I guess I lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Well, in your case, it sounds like the solution to being able to afford cancer ended up happening. It happened to be your startup because, like, it could have partially led to you having cancer in the first place, you know, with all the stress and everything. But at the same time, fortunately, the company took off at the same time that the cancer did. And so it kind of overlapped just in time.
Yeah. Right? It is still stressful, and I'm a little nervous about being back full time and escalating the disease because of the stress. I don't know what to do though, because it's not like I can just stop working. I'm not there yet.
A little bored. Are you guys looking for a new CEO?
Yeah. But even if, you know, I don't think it's just as easy as just replacing me. I personally just don't. What would I just do? Like hang around? I don't know what I start.
Go fishing.
Well, I don't have the money in the bank or anything. You know, I don't pay I pay myself less than a lot of my employees, which is probably just stupid. But I think it demonstrates something. I think it's a good sign if the leaders aren't just driving Maseratis or whatever.
I have a couple of questions about this whole process and sort of thinking of when you got sick again, when you posted that message saying this is what's happening, you know, who can provide sort of ideas. I remember there were a lot of scientific responses. There were a lot of doctors, this and that. There were also a lot of quote unquote thoughts and prayers.
Yeah.
And this is something I personally want to know, like, you know, does that help? Like, should people do that?
Yeah. I think it helps people who can't. Yeah. I don't necessarily, I'm not super, you know, my mother and prays for me and I think she believes it worked and something did work. So I'm happy to, have people pray for me, but telling me that I think it's pretty, it's an easy way to get out of doing actual things that matter. But if it helps people to say it, they can knock themselves out. I don't know. Is that what you're asking? Whether I'm not religious and
neither am I. But even the religion aside, you know, when that, I've seen this happen, maybe not necessarily with stage 4 cancer, but in situations kind of like that, right? People would always want to provide support, but really it makes my eyes roll a little bit. Cause I'm like, the thoughts and prayers are just like, I don't know. Some people say, you know, just saying, thinking of you, like, hope you get better helps. But like, well, how about some actionable stuff, right?
And I agree. Like in your case. If any of your listeners want to actually help somebody they know who has cancer, so one of the things, if you ask somebody, like, what can I do to help? You know, that's something. And I'm not, like, tons of amazing people came out of the woodwork. Like, I would not be here if people didn't just deal on such incredible levels. Like, actually one of my investors in New York gave us an apartment for 3 months in New York, just put me and my family up, like unreal. They actually helped me get to MSK. Like people did amazing stuff, but, you know, one of the things cancer patients get is like, what can I do? And everybody means well, and I've done it myself, but when you ask them, what can I do? You're essentially giving the cancer patient a job. Like, oh, I've got to figure out something for you to do now. And then if I say no, you feel like you're rejecting them. You know, everybody really, truly wants to help. But what, like most people have pretty obvious needs. Like if you want to help a cancer patient, not me, I don't want people doing this to me, but like, rake my yard or like paint my house or, you know, like just do it. I don't even want to hear about it. If stuff magically gets done, and I don't have to think about it, that's like something super helpful. But asking me what to do, what can I do to help is, and everybody, it's not about me. Everybody knows, everybody means well, but, for me at least, that's like, it's kind of maddening because then you just feel bad because I don't know what you can do to help and I don't want to think about, it's like a chore for me to go figure out something you can do to help. So if you know cancer patients and you want to help them or you know people who are sick from anything, just go do the thing. You know, don't use a proxy. Don't just rake their yard or clean their car or bring them dinner and then get out of the way. You know?
It's actually sounds surprisingly like what you should do if you want to help new parents.
Totally. Exactly. Exactly. All right. Like you don't, you know, you have no idea. You don't have the energy to think about what you need, but if someone just showed up with a lasagna and was like, here, Kirill, lasagna, there's no meat. Cheers. Like that would be so helpful versus what can I do? You know, I don't know. Can you watch?
And I think people do remember to like bring something, you know, do something, but they often forget the second part where you just got to get out of the way quickly too.
Yeah. That's right. One of the, you know, sort of things you go through when you're sick, one of the, for me at least, the hardest part is that you don't necessarily, you're not in control. Like the worst part about cancer wasn't even just taking chemo, like, or being in surgery, but you lose, you know, every 2 weeks you had to poison yourself for 2 or 3 days. And you wake up after the third day of chemo and you're like, okay, I'm back. I'm like, I'm going to go do this, this. And you just like bound into the office or you go and deal on a way, like you're manic because you know you're going to get poisoned in like, you know, 10 days. And you're also not available. Like your energy is so like less than it used to be. So you spend a lot of time just telling people, no, I can't come to dinner. And no, you know, people reach out and of course everyone means well. And of course everyone, like, it's obviously like great that people are thinking about you, but it's also like just exhausting on yours and just saying, I can't come to dinner. I would love to come to dinner because I feel like I'm probably going to fall asleep at the table. And you don't want to be that. You want to be yourself. You want to be able to talk and you want to be able to hang out and have dinner table conversations. And, you want to be able to kick ass at work and then you just get poisoned every 3 weeks. And it's just that was really like the most maddening part, not the actual physical pain that you're in. Or even like the fear of death, like you get used to that pretty quickly, but just the disappointing people over and over and not, you know, just being a shell of who you were physically.
So would it help if people somehow figure out how to, you know, let you know that they're not disappointed or bugger off and don't talk to Michael for a year is the best way to kind of like keep you from disappointing your friends or what's a good mix there for you and other patients?
You can rake my yard. No, you can, you know, I think the thing you see this with other people who've gone through some sort of physical, they just, you know, hey, checking in, do not reply. Don't worry about, you know, just being straightforward, like I'm just sending this to say I'm thinking of you and don't spend an ounce of energy.
Oh, I see. So like sending you some happy news is a good way of doing it, but yeah, without expectation.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, you want to be connected to the world. Like the worst is when you're completely disconnected and you don't see a way back. And yeah, so it's great when you hear from people then, but the idea when they ask you to, you know, how can I help? You're just like, oh my God, fuck off. I mean, you know, not really, but.
So I have to ask you kind of an existential question.
Sure.
Because a couple of those founders that, you know, provided you some advice, whatnot, a couple of years ago, they have unfortunately passed away. And I know their friends or coworkers and, I think when people pass away, the immediate reaction is that like, okay, I got to do something about my life. Like life is short. You know, I got to get out there, give it to my kids, to my family, go travel, do whatever I wanted to do. Like do it now. Mm-hmm. But then a couple of weeks go by and all of a sudden people are like, but you know, I'm like really comfortable here. And over a couple of months, it seems like that energy that sparks with somebody's death just ends up, you know, dying and they're dying too. And they're back to the status quo and the comfortable living that used to be. How do you feel now that you've had this experience, right? Like, and you know, do you have any advice for people like who haven't had cancer yet and before they do sort of thing, right? Like what should people do with their life?
don't get cancer. So that's like an easy one. No. I don't know. I mean, I think I feel sort of physiologically different. Like I'm definitely mentally different. This is awful. I mean, maybe I was just like an awful human being before I got cancer. I mean, there is sort of a life before and after cancer or any sort of terminal disease or chronic disease. And that is, I absolutely feel more empathy towards people, towards everybody. I think, I was pretty juvenile and good at just being judgmental. And even if I didn't consciously think it, I was probably like, is this person interesting or useful to me or entertaining to me? And if I could figure out whether they were within seconds, you know, I would just be like, okay, I don't want you in my, you know, there's 24 hours in the day and I don't want you to take up any time in it, you know? And I, maybe it's just getting older, but I think I'm much more, I think I'm nicer, which, I wish I was nice, a nice person. I wish I wasn't judgmental my whole life. I wish I was, I mean, that's so sophomoric as a rule, but I think, that's just, I feel better because I'm not being like hyper, not critical, but just like hyper, everything was about being smart up until a point. Like everything was like, is that clever? Is that intelligent? And now it's I'm much more sympathetic to just the rest of my fellow humans than I was. And you know, about traveling or going out and doing stuff, like I want my kids and my wife to go do stuff. Like I want them to go to Italy. We're thinking about doing a family trip, and I like badly want them to go do it. I want them to go to Italy in March for a week to go to Rome. And I don't want to go because I'm nervous that if I sign up and suddenly something rears its head with my disease, I could potentially derail the whole trip. But I love the idea of my family there. I love the idea of my kids and my wife walking around Rome and seeing the sights and eating and stuff. And it would give me great joy if they went. And so it's different than me wanting to go check off some lists. I don't feel that way at all. And I'm also not scared of death. I totally think it's going to be fine. Like everything scary so far in life has been fine. And I think death is the same. I think we either sort of expand into another dimension in death, not necessarily heaven or hell, but I think I don't know if we're done is what I'm saying with death. But even if we are, I think if it just goes black, that's okay too. Like when you go to surgery and you totally black out, you're not in pain. You're just in dark, and it's going to happen to all of us except Peter Thiel, I guess. But I don't know. I guess just be nice, be thoughtful. I definitely try to think. I don't try to have like the most clever answer. I see a lot of people, especially younger people, you see really smart kids, like smart 25-year-olds who it's sort of like in their DNA to just get to the answer as soon as possible. And I don't think that's the goal of most conversations. Like, it's not about knowing the answer first or knowing everything. It's more about examining and having sort of fun with the conversation, I guess.
So it sounds like you've become less active, but more peaceful and more mindful, more just present.
I do think so. I don't meditate or anything, but I absolutely like breathe. I tried to meditate for a while, and my wife said I was just hyperventilating. I didn't know how to meditate, but I love going for walks. I've started playing piano. which I didn't do. I never played. I played when I was a little kid, but I hadn't played in 30 years. I can't run because of this pump inside me, but I swim and I really enjoy that. It's kind of a weird, do you swim?
Occasionally, but I'm sort of allergic to chlorine, so that makes it hard.
Yeah, that makes it hard. I enjoy swimming, and you know, just kind of you're literally underwater, and it's kind of a different.
It feels like there's a movie in here, or maybe you know a book. Well, do you have anything else to tell cancer in the face while we're on this topic?
Well, I don't, you know, cancer, no, but for cancer patients or people who know, who are, you know, family members, who have family members, like stuff is definitely happening. There's a great new book called The Breakthrough by Charlie Graber, who, about immunotherapy. I don't think immunotherapy is going to be this magic cure-all, but I think, you know, targeted therapies, they're just getting incredibly fancy. I mean, my father's actually a gastroenterologist. And when I told him what I had, you know, he was pretty much like, okay, well, you know, that's it. It lights out. And the fact we went and got, like, he couldn't believe the treatment that I got, which he retired just 8 years ago. And it's definitely a brave new world. There's stuff coming online all the time. And people, I think there's 17 million people in America living with cancer. I'm living with cancer and running a company. You know, I have bad days, but I just want, you know, people should know, especially if they've just been diagnosed, that there are ways forward. And it isn't, it's terrifying to get that news. But you know, there are so many options that weren't there just 10 years ago. And even chemo isn't nearly the like chemo used to get it through your vein, you know, a vein in your arm, and your veins were collapsing and your hair was all falling out, you know, and now they've added steroids to chemo and we have our appetite back, and, you know, you can totally live a pretty good life, you know, just on chronic, like treating it like a chronic disease. I guess that's all I would say. Don't die. Don't give up. Don't, you know, there's a path for everybody.
That's really excellent advice.
Thanks. And
yeah. You know, just as a side note, you mentioned the trip to Italy. Yeah. And I would highly encourage you to go because, no, not just because, you know, it would be a nice trip, but my grandparents, I think I mentioned to you, my grandpa passed away at some, you know, not so long ago, also from cancer.
What do you know what kind? Do you remember?
I think there were a lot of kinds going on. I didn't get like a full picture of what was going on, but the point being, they were also going on a trip to Italy a couple of years ago, and then I think he got sick and they postponed, grandma got sick and they postponed, blah, 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 you know, and it's really easy to, I think, put obstacles and say why you're going to postpone now, but later it doesn't get any easier. So like the worst case, your family is going to go without you, but if you plan it to go with them, at least you'll maximize the chances of you being there with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you have a few more minutes, let's talk about some happy thoughts.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't think cancer, I mean, I hate having it, but I've met unbelievable people. You know, I've met people who've just done like the craziest, hardest things. I've like some of the best people I've ever met have been through cancer. So tons of good things have come out of having this. It's just a bunch of bad cells that are giving you a hard time, but it's
so
not
don't have
bad.
Cancer, but if you have cancer, have the best cancer.
Just have a good time. Mm-hmm. Just yeah. Sorry.
No, but let's go back to that Clutch Masters, right? Yeah. That was a couple decades ago, almost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
'99, I think.
But I remember looking at your Facebook, and your kids are now doing something similar. And that's obviously because you're pushing them to do something exciting, right? It's not just go get a job at a Subway. It's like, here, sell something on eBay or go polish some skis. How is that going on? Like, you're teaching them all this cool startup stuff while doing it yourself.
Yeah, my kids are pretty fun, and they are the proud owners of two companies, the Montana Leaf Raking Company and the Montana Ski Waxing Corporation, which is Montana Ski Waxing is ski waxing as a service. So SWAS. And they'll come to your house, get your skis, go wax them and bring them back the next day. So it's door-to-door service.
Geez, talking about the benefits of small town, right?
That's right.
That's great. Yes. Next thing you know, though, Uber is going to get in their business.
Oh, my God. Yes. They are building an app, so watch out. But yeah, I mean, having kids is fun because you can try to make them like, you know, I think this is sort of the path everyone, you're trying to make your kids just essentially not make any of the mistakes that you made. And there's, you know, that's not necessarily the best way to raise kids. Like half of life is just making mistakes and figuring it out. But I don't know. What do you do? How are your kids?
Oh, my kids are great. I'm currently recording with you in the basement where my office is, and I don't know if you can hear it, but there's a bunch of stumping going on and some amount of crying because it's, you know, getting to dinner time. but I think I'm used to that by now. I'm asking this, you know, startup question because for me and my wife and, you know, Jen, right, for us, it's important to raise kids sort of ready for their generation and not for what we're doing and for what happened before us. And that's why it's entertaining and amusing and sort of empowering to see what you do with your kids and encouraging them to do these things, because I think no one's done this to us. And, but now we have this, startup bug, right? And, I'm trying to learn, both of us are trying to learn more what we can do to even, you know, a 3-year-old, to encourage her to be more entrepreneurial, to go and find the answers.
Dude.
I don't know. You know, like people do lemonade stands or that kind of stuff. And I don't really get it because it feels like it's been done before, like
it
a car wash.
Scale.
It's not that it doesn't scale, but it's like, you know, a car wash has been done before. But like, can you think of something that's going to, it's not even the money. It's just like, can it be exciting for you and also maybe generate some sort of not even talk money, let's talk about opportunity, right? Can it generate opportunity?
I agree. I mean, 3 is a little young, dude, I think.
Well, she's 3 and a half, so we're good.
Oh, my bad. Sorry.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, are your kids going to college?
I don't know. I mean, is college still a thing? Do we, like, it seems, I thought there was like a question about the ROI and everything. I mean, my kids will go to, I mean, I'm a liberal arts person and it drives me nuts, this whole STEM. I mean, I think everybody should study math and physics and, or, you know, some of the traditional, I hate the idea of my kids going and being CS majors. I think that is just a joke. I think computers are amazing, but, the idea that we're all going to become technicians and save the world is, just going to generate a bunch of, like, thoughtless citizens. I mean, I think that's like dystopia if everyone's out there programming computers. I do think that'll even out now that everyone's programming computers, and it's not, you know, I think ultimately liberal arts majors, you need someone to be your boss, and I think those are people who can sort of think in full paragraphs. So I would pay for my kids to go to a liberal arts school, like a good one. You know, we have great schools here, University of Montana, Montana State. I'd pray for them to go to like an Ivy League school or some specialty school, like a weird, like Colorado School of the Mines or something. But, I'm not, if they tell me they don't want to go to college, I'm not, I won't feel too strongly about it. I obviously don't think, you know, I was a German major and I have a master's degree in creative writing, and here I am running a technology company. It's hard to convince me that you need some specific degree to do anything.
Yeah. And, I'm glad you're saying that. And I think I've heard this from a number of smart and successful people on the podcast and outside of it. And I'll go out and say it, right? Because I think a lot of people don't realize that the message, let's teach everyone to code, really suits the companies who are spreading the message. You know,
totally.
Google and Facebook, like somebody still needs to write test codes for those companies.
Oh my God. It's so like, let's teach you how to be corporate like servants.
It's like that's Henry Ford and back in the day saying, let's teach you how to change tires because, well, right. Somebody's got to do it, but...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's anything wrong with learning code. And my kids, you know, play around with Python and stuff. And I like coding. I think it's fun. I do not think it is a valuable way to spend your college education at all. I'd much rather. I mean, just like pure engineering is better. Math is totally interesting. Our VP of engineering is a math major. Actually, so is our new CMO. I don't know. You know, just do hard things. It doesn't matter what. Just do really difficult things. I think that's what you look for in young employees, like people who have proven they can just do something that's challenging and whatever it is, whether it's in programming or writing. I think writing a novel is really hard. Teaches you patience, teaches you how to show habituality, how to show up and keep after something. So I just think young people should go try to do difficult things, whatever it is, and be able to communicate too. Like that's why I like English majors or philosophy majors.
Do you think young people should, or in case of your kids, you know, jump in into college or startup or work, or should they go and be like, I don't know, a paragliding instructor for a year or something like that and just absorb life and do things that necessarily... part of me feels like our parents' generation, you know, had work was different. So they had to work 9 to 5 for many years, same company. But nowadays with remote work finally catching on, right, and jobs being so different, you can actually do things differently. You can go work for a few years for a company, make some money, and then retire for 5 years and then come back and go to college or whatever, right? Like you can do it completely differently. Do you feel the same?
I do. I don't think, you know, one, I don't think that they should think about corporations as like this goal or working for a corporation as a goal in any way. I'm trying to, you know, with the Montana Ski Waxing Corporation and the Montana Leaf Raking Company, I am basically, you know, my dream is that they just have this company that's sort of running by the time they get to college. You know, a lot of success for a company is just literally, I mean, I think Paul Graham says this, it's not dying, right? Like if you just don't die, you will eventually be successful. And so I like the idea of them having this ski waxing corporation for 10 years. And then when they're adults, maybe they have 2 or 3 employees, you know, like I wouldn't want to do straight retail, obviously, because Amazon is just out there dropping stuff from drones on you. But I would like, I think services are really good businesses, like things that you can't export, window washing, painting, waxing skis, things that actually you can't, you know, Amazon can't come in and paint my house. I mean, maybe they will, but if I were a young person, I'd start like 3 or 4 of those businesses. Maybe they're seasonal and you're not trying to make a lot of money, but you're just getting to the place where you can employ 2 or 3 people. And then you're kind of living off, you know, the top of that and then start another. I would like to, you know, I would recommend people just start, doesn't have to necessarily be a $1 billion company, but just start 1 or 2 companies early on. Cause A, that's better than an MBA. You'll learn everything you need to know within 6 months. Right. And B, it's interpersonal skills. It's like the value of a dollar. And that's what I hope my kids do while they're trying to figure out what they want to do. I mean, don't get me wrong about education. I would love if they wanted to go into medicine or if they wanted to study something very hard. But I don't know. What do you want your kids to be?
Interesting question. I
think, what are they? You have a boy and a girl?
I have two girls. I have two girls, and they're very same in some ways and very different in others. And I think, you know, to me, almost asking myself what they want to be is a silly question. Like, I'd want me to create an environment for them where they could be successful.
Yeah.
And to me, that probably means, you know, financially stable, where they can take time to choose what they want to be. Or if they want to be something that doesn't generate a lot of revenue, that they can afford to do that. Because I think, I feel like going forward, there's going to be a huge disparity between rich and poor, kind of Elysium style.
Yeah.
And I think it's important on us to prepare our kids for that, right? Because there's going to be a switch one day. It's going to hit really hard. And if you're not on one side, you're going to be on the other.
Yeah. I mean, there's a revolution. Like, I don't even like thinking about it, but obviously the way things are headed feels like there's going to be a correction with the societal differences, and population wise, I kind of wouldn't want to be on I wouldn't necessarily want to be on the 1%. I don't know. I think about that with pay. You know, I have young employees here. And as I said, I don't pay myself. I have people who make more money in the company than me. And I really do that so that I don't forget. I think it's the right thing to do, but really it's like it forces you to really think about the business. I think if I was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a month or a year or whatever, I would, if you just live a slightly different life than your clients, than your staff. And that wouldn't, I could see that being not productive.
You know, I think like cats don't have to lose for the dogs to win.
Right.
And I would be very happy if myself and my kids, if we could get to a point where it's not even that you have to be a billionaire, right, or be in 1%. You just have to be in a place where you can generate income to enjoy other things. Because I think there's so many other things around us that are important, like, you know, hiking, riding, fishing, swimming, you name it, right? We're like, most of the society currently lives for enjoying those things outside of work hours. But I feel like we have matured far enough as a world where we can flip that and say, okay, you know, we collectively going to figure out a way to make money so that we can all enjoy those things. Because I think if we're all enjoying those things, that we can like appreciate and take care of our planet. And that's more important long-term than actually just making a ton of money. Because, I mean, sure, a couple of billionaires are going to live on Mars, but for the rest of us, there's only sort of one planet left. And we're pretty good at destroying it. So I think that's also important. But
I mean, it's going to be an amazing one. So our kids are going to live to be like 180, right? Like, they're going to literally cure cancer. They're going to figure out all this stuff. So the kids are going to live a long time. They're going to have to make some hard decisions because we didn't, you know, around the environment, around mass destruction, you know, weapons of mass destruction. If they get through it, it's going to blow our minds, right? Like, it's going to, like, there will be, you know, colonization of Mars. There will be like people creating energy out of Pop-Tarts. There will be amazing things if we can just get there without killing everybody first. It seems like we're in this teenage stage with technology, right? Like, we've got the technology, we just don't fully understand how to use it without killing each other first.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, so note to you, I guess, and to listeners, if you haven't read this book by the Patagonia founder called Let My People Go Surfing,
yeah,
I'd highly recommend it, because I thought it was, it's what you'd expect from Patagonia, but it's also all about environment and sustainable future and, you know, how you can create, run, and maintain a company in a way that takes care of employees and maintains the planet.
Yeah. And I think, actually, that speaks to what I want my kids mostly to be able to do, is to make things, to feel in control. You know, what's his name? I can't remember the founder's name.
The WhatsApp co-founder?
No, the Patagonia.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry, the other one. Yes.
And he, you know, his whole thing was like he built his own climbing gear. And that was sort of how the company, he built things for himself and then started selling them. And I want my kids, like I work, like that's the most terrifying thing with them sitting there with their phones all day is that they're just consuming. They're not necessarily, they're not making things. And coding is one way of making things. But I, you know, I love it when I see my 15-year-old trying to fix his bike. You know, like that's like what I really hope for them is that they feel some agency and they can, you know, build their own whatever. You know, cook their own dinner is like a low bar, but you know, I'm so thrilled every time I see my 15-year-old actually cooking something that isn't pre-made or something, you know. Man, you're going to be so... Anyway, go on. Sorry.
No. What were you saying?
I was just saying you're going to be a pretty funny teenage dad. But
you mean me as a dad or my kids?
You as a dad. I mean your kids. I feel sorry for. But
I mean, you know, if what they say the three-nager stage, if that's any indication of what my older one is going to be as a teenager, it's going to be a ride.
How many companies have you started before the kids? You had like three up, I think, at one time. Well, this is your third in the Bad Dad podcast.
Oh, I don't count these things as companies. I mean, I think we've only had like one serious company and everything else was just like projects. Yeah. I mean, and how many I haven't started, right? There's a whole running list of things. I'm a little better now at optimizing for doing things that will probably make money. Right. That is just an exciting thing that I'm doing. I think it's important. And I, you know, even if it's a couple thousand people that listen to each episode, I think it's delivering value to people and that's all I can ask for.
But do you well, never mind. I'm just.
No, it's fine.
I mean, what do you think? Do you find any difference or any similarities between kids and your startups?
They both keep me up at night.
Yeah.
No, I think having had a startup is the best way to prepare yourself for kids.
Yeah.
In many ways, in both, you know, now that I've had kids, I think when I do my next like real thing that's going to consume all of my time, I'm way more prepared. In many ways, but I think specifically patience and attention to priorities and ability to manage people, right? I think before this, I was pretty good at leading people in a number of occasions. But after having kids, I think just my patience for mischievous things or just like dealing with people is so much higher because, as you know, right, kids are always doing something. And also, you can't really, if you really want to embrace, I think, kids and let them be themselves. So then you can't just go ahead and tell them what to do. Like you have to work with them and negotiate and let them do what they want to do and have, you know, explain to them. Like it's a lot of work, but once you do it with 3-year-olds doing this with adults who are presumably a lot more, you know, educated and patient themselves, like that'd be so much easier.
Yeah.
I feel like having 2 kids, I can now take on 200 adults easy.
Yeah. Right. One of the things I'm trying to get my kids to do use OKRs. Have you ever run into OKRs or used them at work for anything?
You mean like you'll have them set up their own goals and then track them? And
It's not going very well, but yeah.
Oh, well, what's an example of one?
Well, let's say, okay, so the fall. An easy one is have enough money to buy your own ski pass. And so how could you do that? You could wax 100 skis. You could not spend your allowance on anything. So those are the key results would be 100 skis waxed, allowance 80% saved or something, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, or like whatever they want to do. My 15-year-old wants to go on a school trip to Lebanon, I think. And so how do you get to Lebanon from Missoula, Montana? I mean, financially, the actual, like, what do you need? Shots, you know, all the actual results that get you to Lebanon.
Yeah, no, those are great things.
Or make, you know, he wants to make, you know, be on the cross-country team. So how do you make the varsity cross-country team? And run 10 miles a day. I don't know, whatever it is. But it's an easy way to like give them goals and make things trackable or, you know, just make things straightforward. Everything seems like this mystery to them. And one of the things I hate is when they think, well, I'm not good at that. That's like the most awful thing I ever hear. When someone says, I'm not good at it, especially a young person, you're like, what are you talking about? How do you know? You're 14. You could be good at anything.
Or like you can be not good at it for a really long time and still be better than a lot of people. But you know what you said about OKR? So Jen and I were just talking about the other day how in college you often don't have time to do it because you're so stressed and busy. But the best way to actually get the most value out of a class is if you read the book before you go to class.
Yeah.
So that instead of listening to the material during the lecture, you just ask questions and verify your theories and that kind of stuff. And I think what you're doing with your kids is the same idea for life, right? Like you, and this is to all the listeners, right? Like I think that's a great way to encourage your kids to like think of on their own, because you essentially say, okay, set up the goals and think through how you're going to do it before you're going to try to do it, right? Because then you can validate whether you're getting there, and you're not a passive consumer anymore. You're like proactively getting something done.
Yes, I agree.
So, last question.
All right.
Hopefully, maybe. Uh-oh. So, and then dinner. Yeah. Giving your experience with everything, you know, from the bubble 1.0 to a startup to getting sick and the kids. What are you doing about your family's health to make sure that like everyone can live to 180?
Yeah. I mean, we eat very well. You know, my teenager definitely eats a bunch of junk. I mean, it's amazing how many calories a day they consume. You know, he'll eat like a stick of butter. Like, it's just crazy. But other than him wolfing down like waffles and pizza, and we eat really well. I used to run, and both of them are runners, and that's makes me super happy. I love running as a sport, like cross country. If you can get your kids to, you know, some of these sports are like super equipment intensive and they're literally violent. And if you can get them into running where there's no equipment and literally all they do for training is they go run, it's like the best. So I love that both my kids are runners. I like skiing, as you know. I think the last time we saw each other was skiing, right?
You're a mad skier.
Thank you. Well, I love skiing with them. I feel very fortunate that they're both into it. I have unfortunately spent their college fund on skiing, on their ski racing. We hike. We live in Montana. I feel we're pretty healthy. I'm definitely the most unhealthy out of all of them. So I don't do anything specific. I mean, I'm pretty hands off as a dad. I just try not to be too bad of an influence. Mostly, get out of their way.
No, I think
great kids. You know, surprising. I'm amazed that they're not delinquents like I was.
I think that's part of also you guys living in Missoula, that you can be hands off and also still very involved and very influential, because you're not on the pressure cooker like we are out here on the coast where, you know, kids assign up for like 16 activities a day.
Yeah. I go visit friends in Portland and they're just like in the car from 3 to 8 every night. I can't even imagine. It would drive me nuts.
So if somebody has a family and, you know, they're tired of coastal living, pressure cooking, or, you know, maybe they just want to get out of San Francisco and they're moving to Missoula, what do you think they would expect and should, like, look forward to as a family?
Yeah. Well, we're hiring. We're looking for a product designer right now.
Submittable.
Submittable is hiring. If you go to submittable.com/jobs, I think. What you would expect, you know, at first it's probably a little euphoric because you're just, there's no like traffic, there's no ride to work that's more than 10 minutes. The schools are amazing. The work isn't a joke. Like, obviously, you'd be amazingly lucky to work for us. But the
best work,
best company in all of Montana. It truly, like, my kids can kind of, I don't know, like, they can walk out the door and be gone for a day and I have no idea. I can go skiing and leave them and just gone. And I feel when I go visit my friends in cities that they're pretty on top of their kids, cause they have to be, 24/7. And, I feel very grateful that I can be hands off. I think anybody who came here, that would be like their first, like, oh my God, I don't know. There's whole hours on the weekend where you don't have anything to do and you can go for a walk and not see anyone. You can within 5 minutes be walking up in a mountain. I mean, literally, I live in town and I can go to the M. Hey, did you see that Trump came here yesterday?
By accident?
No, he came to Missoula. I mean, Missoula is a pretty liberal town, so he was hopefully here to like start a commotion, but he came and he did this ridiculous, he came here, but we have two mountains with letters on them. One is an M and one is an L. And there were these massive letters and some, I assume, college kids, but somebody went up and spelled out the word liar on the mountain. So it's huge. I mean, you could see it from you could see it from Air Force One, but you could see it from miles away. These red, white, and blue. Yeah. Anyway, you can walk up that mountain that has the word liar on it from town. Our office is a block from a river, the Clark Fork River, which has surfing in it. It's got a fake wave in it. So during the summer, employees go surfing. You can go fly fishing, all the sort of traditional Montana stuff. But actually, you can also go, you mentioned paragliding. People jump off these, like at lunch, you look out the window and there's people flying around in paragliders. I don't know. I personally, I mean, I think we used to talk about this when we were in Mountain View that, like, one, there's no mountains in Mountain View. And two, like, those are just like it's like strip malls with Maserati dealerships. It's like just
Mountain View is a horrible place. Don't live there. Here's a message to everyone.
Yeah, like awful, like the worst place on earth. I mean, I think about this whenever I was raising money and I was dealing with like a, you know, hyper smart, aggressive person on the other side of the table. And I'm, you know, in the beginning I was super, you know, I'm from Montana and I'm not, you know, Y Combinator was illuminating, but I really didn't know what I was doing when I was raising money. And the thing that fortified me, because you get rejected most of the time, was if this person's so smart, why do they live here? Because it is a shithole. Like all of Mountain View, all of like Silicon Valley. I mean, I understand it used to be rural, but now it is just, it's just like strip mall, fake city, strip mall, highway, strip mall, fake city. Just like, why do people, like, it's crazy. If you're a capable, educated, wealthy adult, and you put up with that every day. It just blows my mind. Like, you either think you're never going to die or you don't fully understand like our temporal time on earth and how much better like other parts of the world are. Sorry.
No, it's, it's really hard to see that. I think when you're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't have a family and you want to start a company and you want to just work on it all the time, some of it makes sense, and that your friends and your VCs live kind of, you know, 10 minutes Uber right away. But yeah, in the grand scheme of things, there's so many beautiful, fantastic places all over the country.
No, dude, it doesn't make any sense, because you actually can't, like in New York City or in San Francisco, to go anywhere, it takes like an hour and a half just to like go to a restaurant, to go out to eat. Like all that stuff consumes your day. Even like going to have coffee with your investor or whatever is like 2 hours of just nothingness. You know, here, like I am so efficient. I walk to work. In the beginning, you know, John, Bruce, and I would sit down, we'd code all day, and we'd go home. We didn't even have to walk to work, but like, there's no waste. There's no fluff. There's no traffic. There's no BS coffee. There's no meetings. There's no, you know, there's just focusing on the thing at hand. There's no proxy for the actual doing. And I think it's crazy that people go there. I mean, I understand one or two companies blossom into these billion-dollar companies, but I have a very strong feeling that's all about to end. Like, if you are still living there in 10 years, it doesn't make sense. I totally get it for immigrants. Like, it would make sense to me if I was coming from like a third world country and you're, you know, getting a job is like the next step. But if you're starting on third base, which most educated Americans are, and you live in one of those cities, I don't get it. It doesn't translate to me at all. It actually makes me generally, I think when I meet people who do that, I think less of them. Not since I have cancer, because now I'm super nice, but before I had cancer, I used to think less of them. Sorry.
There's that, you know, Michael pre-cancer coming through.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Working it, Michael, working it. No, Missoula. I mean, the last time I visited you was a lovely city. So I can feel the vibes.
I'm not even promoting Missoula. I'm just promoting anywhere in the world that isn't a strip mall and bunch of Maserati dealerships. You know, like Mountain View in particular is just freaking nuts. Like, that's the dumbest place I've ever been.
And I mean, you know, in Mountain View, for like $4 million, you can probably get like an apartment these days.
Oh my God,
and in
so
Missoula,
amazing.
For $4 million, you can get like an entire mountain with a house on the top.
You can, like, yeah, literally, you like 5,000-6,000. I mean, for $600,000-$700,000, you could get a $4 million house. That's a comparable house.
Well, let me know when the house goes up for sale in your neighborhood, because I'm sold. Yeah.
All right.
But honestly,
sorry.
Yeah. Did you want to finish? Sorry, go on.
No. Got on my rant and I. Now I'm a little sheepish.
No, all things said, I'm really glad that you came on a show and we talked about this, because I think it's really important for people to hear, and that, you know, there's life outside of Silicon Valley. Things happen. You can still run a company. You're a prime example. You know, things are going. It's a normal startup, but things are going well. You know, it allows you to serve a very different life and fulfilling life, and the life that you control.
Yeah.
And you can still, I mean, there's always challenges and sometimes regrets, but you can still have kids, you know, you can do all these things, and there's like, you can take this weird path in life from being a writer to being a startup founder and be successful. So I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Actually, can I like call out some of the great companies that are in Missoula right now or that have started in the last like few years? There's Audience Awards, which is a film, which is an entertainment based, film platform. Orbital Shift, which does shift management and is, you know, like really like a, like going up against the big dogs like ADP, and ClassPass, which was a New York based company, has suddenly, they doubled their staff here. They just got here in January, I think, and they're hiring, they've got 175 people over there, and they're, it doesn't seem like they're going to quit, which is pretty exciting. And then Onyx Maps, which is it started as a hunting company, but now it's basically Google Maps for anywhere that isn't a road. It's essentially off wilderness GPS tracking, and they're killing it. Summit just put $23 million into them. So the fact that you used to not be able to start companies here because there was no capital, so you had to bootstrap everything, which is good and bad. But now you can actually do either. Now, like, there's stuff that you can raise serious rounds. They raised a $23 million Series A. Unbelievable. This company Geofly is like three or four kids that they're killing it. They're selling directly to schools for essentially customizing a school's admissions page based on where the user is coming from. So if you're applying to University of Montana from Baltimore, you'll get a different experience than if you're applying from Missoula. And it's just like, there's companies, and I'm probably missing like 10, Gatherboard, which is another company for community sort of engagement. It blows my mind that there's so much, there are all these companies here. And then there's Submittable, which, you know, out of all these companies, Submittable is obviously the best and has the most promise, but no, I'm just kidding. But I think if you're not living in a town like Missoula, you're not thinking things through.
I think you're right. I think, you know, for everyone who is considering that they're tired of, you know, high rents, high prices for everything, and they're ready to kind of change their lifestyle, Missoula or towns like that is an amazing place to go.
I mean, because you can still be ambitious and also have a great daily life. It's, I don't know.
And you might get to hang out with Michael.
And you might, yeah. Don't ask me for coffee though. Don't ask to go out for coffee though. But no, I'm just kidding. Anyway, thanks for having me on.